Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we have gathered together a panel. First of all, sitting next to me is the lovely Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Hey, Zilpha.
And then joining us from the corners of the world, we have Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up, guys?
So far away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all the way down here.
And Glenn. Hey, Glenn.
Hello.
Welcome back, Glenn.
Thank you.
Tonight
I'm happy to be back. I really am.
Tonight we also have a studio audience of one, but he's radiant. and welcome to the studio, Rich.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We need to name the studio, like Studio One.
Why are there more than one?
Or Studio Fist in Your Face or something.
What's this with the fists?
Something cool.
I'm nervous about tonight.
All right. So tonight we are talking about, it's the beginning of a new year. And, you know, often great big news outlets like CNN or Fox News or Mormon Expression, we all do the same thing, which is we want to review the top stories of the year, the top stories of 2010. So we have taken the team of crack Mormon Expression researchers and come together and pooled our resources and come up with the top 10 Mormon-related news stories for 2010.
Wait, I thought you came up with this list.
Yeah, but we agreed on it. So.
Okay.
Yeah, what's your point?
You said team of researchers.
All right, so let's start out. You guys have any comments before we get going?
Do you think that the year 2010 was actually fairly more newsworthy than other years, or is it just because we were paying closer attention to it and it's really just an average Mormon year, or what?
I would say it's probably kind of an average Mormon year, but I mean, I haven't really been paying that close of attention. What do you think?
I'd give it a 6.
A 6 out of what? Does yours go up to 11?
Yeah, I'd give it a 6 out of 13.
Jeez.
Yeah, a 6. I think that's what it was.
Yeah, about average. Yeah, I would agree.
I thought when I was first going to do this, we're going to do like the top 20, but top 10 was hard enough.
Yeah, there's a few on here that probably people like, that was newsworthy? Come on.
Yeah, well, I mean, and when we were talking about doing this, because I don't live in Utah and I don't get whatever newspapers you guys get, and I'm not really a news junkie, I don't know. I had to look up almost every single one of these things that you provided on the list and kind of play catch up.
Really?
There were a few that I knew about, but most of these were news to me. I just had to go and catch up on them.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start at number 10. This is a story that was late breaking in the year. The Swiss missionary brouhaha. Did you guys all follow that story in the news?
Was it officially called a brouhaha?
That's what it says on my paper. So the story goes that there was a law in Switzerland passed in 2002 that they finally got around to enforcing, I guess, and the Swiss government is not going to allow Mormon missionaries from Utah and Idaho or wherever else outside of Switzerland to come into the country anymore and do their proselyting. Now, that story is sort of interesting in and of itself, but I think the real story is in the immediate political maneuvering that happened by the 13 congressmen and senators led by Harry Reid, who started to really put pressure on both the U.S. embassy staff and the Swiss government, and it sort of took people by surprise the swiftness and combined nature of their response.
But also, isn't it true that there hasn't actually been like a concrete decision made? Last I had heard that the LDS Church was trying to appeal it, or they were going to try to negotiate a deal or something like that.
Yeah, the Swiss government, I think, was sort of taken aback by this and thought, well, I mean, why are you getting involved? And they sort of defended it. I think on fairly rational basis from their laws, because they classify what the missionaries do as employment. And of course, that's partly in place because of the law change that happened in the early 90s. was it the late 80s, when the church changed its structure in order to avoid people paying taxes, and missionaries are actually paid by the church.
That's right.
To, yeah. So they are purposes. Employees,
yeah,
technically.
And it's I'm sure some tax attorney is going to tell us that we got it wrong, but if you've had missionaries out, you know that you pay to the church and the church pays the missionaries. It's not a direct payment to the missionaries like it used to be. So this is probably the first sign of that. Now,
so does it affect other churches, or is it
yes,
mainly just the Mormons?
But there's not very many proselyting churches anymore.
And you said, right, John, that the law is that they won't accept any foreign missionaries from the U.S., only missionaries. Is it from Europe, or is it specifically from Switzerland?
Now, I don't know how your European Union laws apply, but it basically has to do with getting a work permit in Switzerland and all sorts of technical stuff that I didn't care about. But to me, the real story was the Mormon political machine is alive and well. The church clearly got their 13 congressmen to act really quickly and in one accord. And these are guys that don't necessarily get along. You know, Reid is the House Majority Leader, the most powerful Democrat in the United States, and you've got a lot of wacko Republican, you know, Idaho congressmen, and they all came together and came down on the Swiss booyah.
Booyah.
All right. So what's going to happen? As we look ahead, because this doesn't go into effect until, 2012, that the U.S. missionaries will be kicked out of Switzerland. Like, no U.S. missionary has been kicked out yet, right?
Hey, as far as I understand, I think personally you're seeing the first cracks. I think that proselyting missionaries is a thing of the past. It's an archaic thing that really only marginal fundamentalist and religions and cults do anymore. And it seems archaic. I'm not saying the Mormons are a cult, but those are the type of people you see doing this sort of active, high-pressure recruiting that the Mormon church engages in. And it's becoming increasingly foreign in our world.
And when you say archaic and stuff like that, I'm thinking like 50 to 100 years ago. But I was like, I just served in the 90s, man. It wasn't that bad.
But I guess
the LDS church really is what, one of maybe a handful of churches that still heavily proselyte?
Right. Yeah. That's my point. And you look at your, you know, sometimes you need to look around to see who you're hanging out with to get what sort of social group you're in. And if you're hanging out with all, you know, the geeks and nerds, I have news for you. You're a geek and a nerd. So if, you know, you're hanging out with the Jehovah Witnesses and the, you know, the Moonies and all that kind of stuff, well, you know, you're hanging out in that hall.
So I only have one point to make about this this particular list topic, is that this kind of flies in the face of spreading the gospel to every nation. We're supposed to be going forward, not backwards. You know, we're supposed to get to all the nations, not nations kick us out.
It's true, but we have been kicked out of lots of different countries.
We can always get back in, I guess. That's always the hope.
No,
right?
But Tom, there's something in there about the fulfillment. What is it? The time of the Gentiles being fulfilled, when things will start slowing down. It's one of the signs of the times.
Oh, really? Isn't the times of the Gentiles being fulfilled?
Yeah,
it's
supposed to happen right before
the
Jews accept the gospel.
But I don't think the gospel is close to filling the earth yet.
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, kind of a parting statement, there is some symbolism in this, in that after the war, you know, all the missionaries were pulled out of Europe for the war. Switzerland was sort of the basis of the growth of the church. That's where the first temple was built. So, you know, it seems sort of symbolic that it's the first place that the missionaries are sort of being not allowed to go. Now, if you're a Mormon there in the country, you're welcome to serve. It's just foreigners. All right.
Sounds good.
Number nine, the Rome, Italy temple groundbreaking was on October 23rd, 2010. I think this isn't a huge story, but I think it has, first of all, a counterpoint to number 10, which is ex-Mormons and sort of anti-Mormons like to focus on the idea the church isn't growing. Well, the church is still growing. It's still extending out there, and here they are building a temple in Rome, as I understand, not too far from the Vatican. I think this temple is interesting on several levels. First of all, you know, the Rome is, of course, the seat of the great and abominable church.
according to Broussard.
According to the Book of Mormon. and I think that the temple looks like something out of the movie Metropolis. You know, it's interesting to see German expressionist buildings right there in the middle of Rome. I don't know why the Italians are standing for that.
I also remember when they announced there was kind of a whoosh, you know, like, wow, ooh, in the audience. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, and if you go to LDS.org, you can find their little movie where they've capitalized on that, sort of pumped up that audio a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Did they announce the temple in Independence, Missouri yet?
No,
we're just waiting for the permits to go through.
Let me know when they announce that one,
and then I'll get excited.
We've got our handcart ready.
It's
in the garage in case we need to go. But there's one other thing that's very interesting about the temple. They have a fly through that has a digital mock up, and on the big wooden doors of the temple is
Holiness to the Lord.
A great big cross.
No way.
So maybe
they'll take that off later.
Maybe Mike Reed has finally won the church over and convinced him that the cross is okay in Mormonism.
Yeah, and while we're at that, can I make a retraction? Because I said on the 100th podcast that wasn't very interesting to me. I shouldn't have said that. That was a stupid thing for me to say.
Well, I thought it was a good podcast.
I know. So. I just shouldn't have said that. That was stupid for me to say. I'm sorry, Mike.
Oh,
Mike. You can send your hate mail to djaustin@gmail.com.
All right. Well, okay. I'm finding back my news stories. Okay, so that's the Rome, Italy temple. Big news in the Mormon corridor. Probably not much of a splash elsewhere, but I think it's noteworthy. Okay, number eight, the forged Mountain Meadows massacre document by Hoffman was found and announced. Hoffman, who did his last killing about 25 years ago, has been in Point of the Mountain since. One of his documents surfaces.
Where did they find it?
This document has been around for a while. In fact, both Tom, I think you were going to say what I'm about to say, so go ahead.
Yeah, this document has been around for a while, and it's been cited in several books that have been written about the Mountain Meadows massacre. Wow. So it was just, I can't remember who it was that actually did a test to see if it was actually authentic, and that's when he raised suspicions, and that's when they announced that it was a forgery. Do you remember who it was, John, that announced it?
I'm not sure who found it. I mean, to go back, for those who aren't familiar, Hoffman was, of course, a documents dealer who had this uncanny knack for finding exactly the documents that everybody was looking for. And his thing went south about 25 years ago, and he started placing pipe bombs. And he had a pipe bomb that went off in his own car and sent him to the hospital, gave him some injuries. The church brokered a deal with the Utah Attorney General to keep it out of court, and that's why Hoffman never got the death penalty. I think one of the things that's interesting about this, there was a forensics guy, I think it was for the FBI or something, finally figured out how to get Hoffman.
That's right.
Because there was a telltale cracking in his ink. Whatever method Hoffman used to age his document, ink on his documents, left this little sign. So they didn't necessarily know that it was of not old origins, but they were able to piece it together, and all of his documents had that. So if you look at it under a microscope, and you know what you're looking for, you can spot a Hoffman forgery. So I guess nobody ever did that with this one.
Several things that should be noted about this particular document is it doesn't really say anything in particular. It's just more of a reference kind of thing. And the LDS Church actually put it in their newsroom stories just to clarify something. It says, although not a critical historical document related to the massacre, it was cited in Massacre at Mountain Meadows, a book co-authored by Richard Turley.
Yeah, Richard Turley Jr., who is the church assistant historian, has been for a while. He's a lawyer. He co-wrote a book about mountain meadows that came out a couple of years ago. And Will Bagley also used this in his book. Interestingly yes. enough, when I was researching, there were some sort of apologetic types who like try to light Bagley up for using this document. But Turley used it also.
Yeah.
So who owned the document?
I'm not certain, but it was one
I think it was at the University of Utah or Utah State. Somewhere it was a college, I think, had it.
And it was like in their card system, and it was in a place that wasn't updated. I remember reading it. I just don't remember the details of it now, but it wasn't updated when the Hoffman stuff came to light.
This just fell through the cracks. This probably won't be the last time we hear about a forged document being found by Hoffman.
No. And I think that's the real interesting thing here. I mean, the impact of Hoffman on the church even reverberates today, and you know, shows up in works of scholarship and all that kind of stuff. That the man, you know, was obviously despicable, willing to kill innocent people, but he was a genius of the first order, and the sort of documents that he could come up with and the methodologies he used are just awe-inspiring even today.
Hey, when did the two words
scary smart?
Yeah, scary smart. When did the papyri show up in Chicago?
In the 1960s, I believe.
67 right? is when
they
came out.
So he would have been
67.
Alive then, right?
No.
You think there's any way he could have like forged the entire Mountain Meadows incident, that it never actually happened? He just
wouldn't that be nice?
You know, keep that up and you might have a promising career in apologetics.
I was just trying to help Tom out.
Well, let me ask you this, John.
Thanks, Glenn, for your help.
I'm just trying to do my job.
Can you guys hear Rich?
Can you guys hear me? Hello.
Yeah.
Maybe you said this, John. What did the document reveal? I mean, what was the document?
The document was a side document about a guy who was asked to come because the Indians had massacred. But when he got there, that hadn't happened yet. And he was sort of enlisted into the army of, you know, that attacked. So it was sort of a side supporting document to suggest there was, deceit and stuff going on, but it really wasn't instrumental to the main story. And that's really how Hoffman operated. He would take, you know, thoughts and ideas, really a lot like Joseph Smith. We should do a whole podcast comparing Hoffman to Smith. But, and then he would find that crack, and most of his stuff wasn't too, you know, off the normal. So it seemed like it could be there. But, you know, because
Rich in Mormonism Unveiled, Lee told a story about sending either Edwards or Adair to Cedar City to send a message. And he couldn't remember if it was Edwards or Adair. And so Mark Hoffman read that and he saw that there was some wiggle room. So he wrote in this letter that it was Edwards.
I see.
And the document provided that. But we don't know whether it was Edwards or Adair, but the letter that he forged said it was Edwards. I mean, so it was a really insignificant detail.
Sure, but it had enough credibility to hold water.
Yeah.
It was really smart of Hoffman to do that, because this particular piece of information doesn't really cred pro or against the church. It's just kind of there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the way most of the Hoffman forgeries are. You know, the most sensational one everybody knows about is the Salamander letter, but even that's not that over the top, and that's why people would buy into it.
Yep.
Okay, story number seven. This one is sort of sad. Bishop Clay Sanner, a 42-year-old Mormon bishop in a small city outside of, I think, San Francisco, was shot to death in the early summer by a mentally ill individual, 47-year-old Kenneth Ward. Unfortunately, it happened between meetings at church. Kenneth had he was an excommunicated Mormon, had a long history of mental disturbance and other activities, and came into church, busted into his office, shot Clay in the foot. Clay heroically sort of clawed his way out of the office to try to get people to get out of the way, and then Ward shot Clay to death. Ward was a couple hours later gunned down by police at his apartment.
And also Ward was a former member of the church. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe he was an excommunicated member, but he was definitely an ex-Mormon. And there had been some other altercations. Like a few years earlier, there had been a suicide attempt where he and his wife had tried to commit suicide with pills or something. I don't know. And they'd written like anti-Mormon and anti-gay slurs on their walls. So obviously this guy was unstable.
Yes.
But, you know...
Did he pick out that bishop randomly, or did he know that bishop?
Well, the connection, he didn't know the bishop, but this was the church building that he grew up in.
Mm.
So he drove 140 miles from Modesto to Visalia, and he told his family in Modesto that he was going on a fishing trip, and he drove down to Visalia. He went to his childhood town. He walked into his former church. He found this bishop that he didn't know, but, you know, associated with whatever bishop, you know, he had been as a child. And he had been excommunicated in 1988, but here he is, a 47-year-old man going to wherever he went as a child and shot this bishop that was in, you know, his old bishop's office.
It's interesting
the theory
go ahead, Tom.
Oh, sorry. The theory that I heard was that, he was holding some sort of grudge, looking for some sort of church leader. So it was kind of a random thing, but he had, you know, it's really hard to tell his motivations, but.
Well, it seems strange that he would have both anti-gay and anti-Mormon stuff on his walls. Isn't that what you said? So it could have been some kind of scouting, you know, incident.
Well, he had a long history of, you know, anti-slurs and threats and stuff with the church.
Yeah, like John said, I mean, even his family said that he suffered from severe mental illness. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, his brother said in the paper that he thought that he suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome from the Gulf War.
Wow. Hmm.
So, I mean, it shows that, you know, religious persecution, you know, on all sides is still alive and well. And this is an unfortunate incident because things have been running so hot in California with Proposition 8 and that sort of thing. And just, you know, the Clay, he had six children. The youngest was 6 months. It's just an awful, awful
thing. Yeah, it's terrible all the way around. I feel terrible for his family. That's not good at all.
Okay. Story number six. I think this is a very fascinating one and sort of peels away some of the layers of Utah. The firing squad death of Ronnie Lee Gardner. Now, Ronnie Lee Gardner was, of course, an awful bastard who's been around for a long time. He was on trial for the accused murder of, I think, Melvin Ottersum, I think, was the guy who he killed in a 1984 robbery at a bar. But in 1985, he had an escape attempt from the Salt Lake City courthouse in which he killed attorney Michael Burdell. And that's what he was on death row for. Now, the interesting thing about this story is he was killed by a firing squad. And there are a lot of reasons that Utah still has a firing squad. Does anybody want to take a guess?
I know what you're going to say.
Let it tell me.
Can I read say this little louder. Paragraph that's in Wikipedia on it?
Sure.
The execution of Gardner at Utah State Prison became the focus of media attention in June of 2010 because it was the first to be carried out by firing squad in the United States in 14 years. Gardner stated that he sought this method of execution because of his Mormon background. On the day before his execution, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints released a statement clarifying its position on the issue of blood atonement of individuals. The case also attracted debate over capital punishment and whether Gardner had been destined for a life of violence since his difficult childhood.
Yeah, so there's a belief among a lot of really conservative Mormons that blood atonement requires the actual spilling of blood.
With a javelin? Oh, we're not bringing that up.
With bullets or whatever. So especially in the early days in the Utah Territory, they shied away from hangings and, you know, because there was this belief that your blood had to actually physically be spilled on the ground. Now, people might say, oh, that's just, you know, old rumor. Representative Cheryl Allen, who was a state representative, tried to push through a reformation of the firing squad in the 1990s. And although at that time the church didn't object, according to Representative Allen, she said that in quiet backroom discussions, in her words, she said that there was a lot of talk about blood atonement. And she said, in her words, I quote, "A couple of people in prominent positions said to me, we've got to have blood atonement." And it's come up over the last 15 or 20 years, several times in the legislature to get rid of it, that it's barbaric, that I think there's only two states that still do the death by firing squad, and it's routinely voted down. And so I think it's one of those things that people say, oh, blood atonement's not there, but then there's these signs around the edges that there's still people who believe in it.
If anything, it shows that the blood atonement did resonate in the state back in the day.
Oh, but where, I mean, if blood atonement's really behind it, where is that being taught? Because I never hear it being taught.
It's an unwritten rule, dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
okay. But if it's unwritten, fine. Where is it being taught?
You've never heard that before?
I never heard of it growing up.
Just from you guys.
Really?
No, I've never heard of it either until just studying in the last couple of years.
Really?
Well, because it was a heavy-handed kind of thing with Brigham Young.
Didn't have very good seminary teachers.
But, yeah. You know, the second anointing, maybe it has something to do with that. So, you know, none of us have gotten that, but the higher ups have.
No, they know
something we don't.
The blood atonement, second anointing don't have anything to do with each other, but it's been around as a folk sort of, and I say folk, you can find a lot of stuff from the 19th century where they talk about it openly. And you know, like I said, there were people who opted out of hangings in Utah because of this whole blood atonement thing. John D. Lee, for one. He wanted his blood spilled on the ground.
Wasn't there something too? I remember studying when this article came out, or when he was executed, that it had to be in like manner, like because he was guilty for shooting someone. Does that have anything?
Yeah,
to do with
that's true.
Okay. Oh, I don't know. That sounds good to me.
There you go. We all learned something.
There's a definite possibility that none of this Mormon stuff had anything to do with it. He may have just been sensationalizing it to get attention. I think that's a definite possibility. That was my first initial reaction. Why would he do that? Oh, to get attention. Okay. All right.
Could be. Okay. Moving forward, story number five, the Ogden Temple facelift. And maybe this one's dear to my heart because this is where I took out my endowments. But what I think is funny about the story is, well, from what I understand, they're just sort of dropping a big concrete box over the top of the temple to make it look like the other temples, but they're not really doing any sort of major restructuring of the temple. So the Ogden and the Provo temples were built in 1972, and they've been sort of polemic ever since. A lot of people think they're ugly.
They look like thumbtacks.
Why? Because they have orange shag carpet? 70s, right?
Now, so they're sort of iconic for me growing up, because I was in the Ogden Temple District. You know, that was our temple. But I've always had explained to me that they were sort of to mimic the pillar of fire that Moses and the children of Israel followed, that they look unlike any other temple. You know, there's sort of there's the Salt Lake Gothic thing, but then all the others have sort of a Protestant country church, just like on steroids feel. But these two temples, they're roundish and they have these gold windows.
Yeah, the gold.
And then they have this white stone base and this steeple that sort of has these jags going up it. And they didn't have a Moroni up on top. Although it used to be the only Salt Lake temple had a Moroni. But yeah, they look architecturally like anything else.
Didn't they put the Moroni on the Provo Temple last year?
Well, they have now retrofitted these temples with Moroni. Ogden Temple has a Moroni now.
Ogden already does have a Moroni?
I think the oldest temples, which are really Manti and Logan, don't.
Well,
but I think all the others have been retrofitted with them.
This was one of the things on your list, John, that made me a little confused. And what you just said, I'm beginning to wonder whether you're a little sad. You sound a little heartbroken about it.
Well, I guess it's funny, a story to me, because the temple was not built that long ago, and Mormons hold the temples to be. You've all heard the story about the elevator shafts in the Salt Lake Temple, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but they were built these.
The idea is
empty.
It's not a story. It's true.
Shafts.
It's not
were
true.
Built into oh, the yeah, heard, temple, and then later right. they turned into the elevator
light fixtures
shafts.
Were the same way, as I recall.
Yeah. So the you know the idea is when the temple was built, there were no elevators yet. Although that's not true. But that they put this shaft in, they're like, oh, we don't know why the hell we're putting a shaft in. And then later elevators were invented, and voila, there they are. But I mean, there's a lot of things wrong with that story. But the temples what? Are like the sign of direct revelation. You know, it's not been polluted by the, you know, medieval scribes or anything. This is pure revelation. And this temple didn't last 30 years before it had to be redone because it's so ugly that nobody wants to go.
Nobody wants to get married in it. People will go to it. They don't want to get their wedding picture taken in front
of it. Don't judge a book by its cover, John. It's what's on the inside that matters.
Well, and it is beautiful on the inside if you've been to one of those, but you know. My parents got married in the Provo Temple.
This is number five because
they have to say it's beautiful.
But your worldview then. That they're just changing the temple because it's no longer a divine.
No, he put it as number five because a little part of him died inside.
I put it at number five because it's a big thing that the church is. It sort of shows that the temple is the one thing the church can't quit mucking with. They're always changing the temple ceremony. They're always changing the meaning of it. They can't leave the outsides alone. It's supposed to be the one thing that's the central pillar of restoration, and they can't keep their hands off of it.
Oh.
So, I agree.
So
I think it's
that's
a big
why they have
deal.
That song. We love to muck with the temple.
We love to muck with the temple.
So I think it's a major thing because it's well, if the temples aren't done by divine inspiration, you know what is?
What makes you think that divine inspiration doesn't change its mind? That happens all the time.
Yeah, that's the problem.
It's what about
divine inspiration is the same today, yesterday, and always. It changes its mind. You haven't figured that out yet?
All right, you've convinced me. Where do I sign back up again? Somebody call the home teachers.
I had a woman tell me when I first moved to Bloomington about 15 years ago, she told me that there's a tribe of white Lamanites in South America that mm-hmm. have been quarrying a special kind of granite to bring up that they're going to use to build the temple to the Lord. And I was just wondering if that's why they're doing the facelift for the Ogden Temple.
You think if it was that special,
any, like white
South they'd probably
American
save
Lamanites.
It for the Missouri Temple. Why would they bring it to
Ogden?
That's
the Missouri Temple?
Yeah.
Oh, you're probably right.
Okay.
Never mind.
Number four, the FPPC fine of the church. The Mormon Church, which of course operated heavily in the Prop 8 kerfuffle. That's the second. No, the other one is a brouhaha.
Yeah, this is a kerfuffle.
Don't mix your brouhahas with kerfuffles.
So in California, 2007, 2008, there was the big Prop 8 where the church got really super involved, and the church sort of tried to operate this underground. You know, we have lots of stories of people being called by their stake president and saying, hey, we know that you pay this amount of dollars in tithing. The Lord feels that you should pay $5,000 to the Prop 8 campaign and all sorts of like shenanigans that the church was involved in. The FPPC, which was, what was it? Did anybody remember what that stands for?
I don't know, but I didn't see that part about the tithing in the news stories that I read.
Really? You hadn't heard that?
Yeah. No, I didn't see
check
that.
Check out
there.
The documentary Prop 8.
I've got that queued up on my Netflix, but I haven't watched it yet.
So were you asking what the FPPC stands for?
Yeah, I didn't write down what it stands
for. It's Fair Political Practices Commission.
Okay. So the Mormon Church was the first religious organization ever to be hit with a fine for malfeasance in California. The charge was they failed to timely report making late non-monetary contributions to YES on Prop 8 in amounts totaling $36,928. It was a slap on the wrist. I think there were 13 violations, but it shows that the church was indeed operating in less than legal manner in their operation.
So how much were they fined?
like $5,000.
Yeah, $36,928 total.
That would be totally worth it to the church.
No, it was just about $5,000that they ended up paying.
It was the $5,000 fine. Yeah, it was the daily reports detailing. Yeah, yeah.
But okay, did report everything. It's just that they didn't report it, was it daily that they were supposed to report it? They reported it within 2 weeks that they were supposed to report it. Right.
Well,
but they just didn't report it every single day. They reported it cumulatively.
I don't know about the day by day thing.
Okay, are you just
playing
devil's
advocate? They were supposed to report it day by day, but instead they reported it collectively at the end of 2 weeks or something. I mean, it was really nitpicky.
Are you playing devil's advocate? Are you really defending the church here? Because I got to know which knife drawer I'm going for right now. Because
no, seriously, John. When I read through this, I just thought this doesn't seem like a big deal to me.
Yeah, and, but and this is something that they could really.
Going through this, reading it,
they
I read
really
like two or three articles, and I just went, I don't understand why this is a big deal.
Look,
because the church was doing a whole bunch of other things that were underhanded, and this is just something that was fairly easy for them to nab the church on, so they went after it.
Yeah, I mean, Al Capone went to jail for tax evasion, right? The church was running a huge machine, and the response to this was over the top, and I think just about everybody will acknowledge if the church hadn't got involved, then this would not have passed.
I'll go watch Prop 8. I've just seen the beginning where there's like fuzzy pictures and scary like authorities on there, and I kind of got scared and hid under my covers.
Why this is so key is the church pretends in many cases to say we believe in supporting the law, but they work very. You know, they've been caught giving bribes in foreign countries and doing all sorts of underhanded things like that. That if you were a member of that stake and you got caught and slapped with an FPPC fine, they could very well disfellowship you. But the church itself did it. And you know, one of my problems that I brought up over and over again with the church is the church has no accountability. So the church here was breaking the law in California. They got caught and what's the effect? Because to its members, everything's on the line. If you make a mistake like this, I mean, you could lose your temple blessings and not see your daughter's wedding and lose your callings. And here the church does this sort of stuff. And, you know, so the fact they got caught with the machine that they have, I think they were probably doing a lot of other things. Now, I'm not saying they were engaged in a lot of illegal behavior, but I consider the church's operation in Prop 8 unethical, in the least.
Did they not render unto Caesar the things that were Caesar's? Well, at least 15% of the things that were Caesar's unto Caesar here.
All right. Anyway.
Tom. Am I annoying you again? It sounds like I am.
Thank you, John. No, my take is I think this is a semi nitpicky deal, but bottom line is they broke the law and they had to pay the fine for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my take.
So what are you going to do about that, Tom? You are a member of a church that breaks the law. What are you going to do?
They're just men, dude.
You know,
they're not infallible.
They're not prophets or anything. What?
Well, that's what I'd like to see him do. I'd like to see him say, "Oh, we overstepped. You know, we're sorry." But you know, the problem with the whole Prop 8 thing is they just seem to be so unapologetic about it. And I can understand that. I'll even grant them that. But when they started claiming victimhood through this whole thing, that's where it jumped the shark for me.
But you know why they did that, John. They got pushed into a corner. I mean, they took a stance.
They were pushing everybody else into the corner.
I know, but they took a stance and they kind of got cornered, and now they're kind of grasping at straws to find out how they can salvage a really, really messy situation.
Right. And the stance was they wanted to take rights away from other people, right? That if Prop 8 hadn't passed, they would still be able to marry in temples and deny marriages to people who don't pay tithing. They would have still been able to go on and do that. But they were reaching out to people who weren't in their congregation, who weren't their people, and saying, you can't do something.
Because we don't believe in it.
For our religion holds that you, who's not even a part of my religion, can't do something. And that's just bullshit.
It is. I'm completely in agreement with you there. I think this whole Prop 8 thing is major egg on their face, and the way they treated, yeah, it's
bad deal.
So, Tom, I want to see something creative come out of you, where you come up with something that says, you know, I'm an apostle, I'm a man, I'm an FPPC violator, and I'm a Mormon.
What?
Can you come up with like some campaign Mormon ad that does this? Yeah.
Thing?
Yeah.
Maybe I have a better question, because this is the last thing that I shed as a member of the church. This is the last thing that I couldn't really carry with me. But I'm curious what, so both Tom and Glenn, you guys are both still believing in church going. Is that, you said,
oh,
Tom?
Hey,
they're church going.
Church going. Yeah, I said believing. I'm sorry. But what happens though? I mean, what really, I mean, are you sticking with they're just men? Or I mean, and I'm not trying to put you in a corner. I'm just really curious if there is a compartmentalization technique you've used or some kind of coping technique you've used to try and make that a real thing. Or is that just fall into one of the many things?
Well, I had a really nice conversation with my bishop that took about 30 seconds in the foyer about 2 months ago. And it had to do with, what does it mean to sustain the brethren? And his definition for sustain was that it means, I hope that they'll eventually get it right.
Oh, gosh.
And I said, man, if that's the definition for sustain, I can raise my hand.
I don't. You better look in the dictionary, because that has nothing to do with sustaining anybody.
If that's what my bishop is telling me that sustain means, I can raise my hand to sustain him.
What a good guy! I like.
Well,
that.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to the top three. You guys might not have liked the previous seven, but I think you'll agree with me on the top three. Number three, the trial and verdict of David Mitchell in the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping. This has been going on for years and years.
And yeah, finally, this is like a big news story for the last 7 years. Yeah.
So David Mitchell, you know, every time they'd call him into court, he'd start singing.
Follow the prophet.
No, his favorite song was, O come, Emmanuel.
He died, the great Redeemer died.
O come, Emmanuel, because he's Emmanuel.
Guy is, you know, it's hard to read the psychological profiles. There were some great lines. Of course, my favorite line that came out from the cross-examination of one of the psychologists is, it's hard to tell.
No, it's impossible.
It's impossible to tell religious fundamentalism from mental illness or something to that effect.
Yeah, that even made, I think that made it into the Mormon Times too.
But it's true. You know, he acts like the guys in the Old Testament, right? I mean, I'm not trying to defend Mitchell, but, you know, they strapped their sons to altars and tried to sacrifice them and kicked women out of the house to go die in the desert. And I mean, those guys were nuts, and David Mitchell was a nut. But I think the best product is all the, if you read different blogs and Mormon Times and Deseret News, the Mormons, as they rationalize, you know, these guys who make us look so bad, and, you know, how do you tell a false prophet from a real one?
The real
by
one wears
the
a
burning
suit.
Burning in your bosom, right?
Oh.
So do you think it was...
I get a little nervous talking about the Elizabeth Smart case.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, just because, you know, they're real people, and it was a real terrible thing that happened to them and their family. But, you know, there's a couple of things that strike me with what happened, and the first one, when I think back of where I was when this whole thing went down, what was it, 8.5 years ago? And, you know, I always had these philanthropic dreams of what I wanted to do with my life, and, you know, helping the poor and homeless people. And when I heard of what the Smart family did, how they first met Brian David Mitchell and invited them basically into their home to give him a break, and how that backfired on the entire family, it scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that was kind of an eye opener for a lot of people. Like, I mean, there's a limit to philanthropic activities when your family is involved and your safety.
That's one take on it.
Yeah.
Another take on it was, you know, he was getting cheap labor
Yeah.
You know, like the guys who go down to the Home Depot and, you know, load the back of the truck up and then pay them in cash. So, and I'm not going to accuse them one way or the other. I'm just saying.
That, right. And that's where I say it gets hard for me to like really talk and kind of critique the Smart family, because I mean, if I'm being honest, when I look at, I get a little scared when I look at Elizabeth Smart's dad.
Well,
he kind of scares me a little.
Yeah,
bit.
Yeah. He has always given me the creeps. He's a rich guy. He's used to getting what he wants, and he's hiring vagrants to come do work on his house with his kids there. And the question is, which is unanswered, of course, is it purely out of the goodness of his heart, or was he just, you know, taking advantage of the loophole in the system?
All right.
It's because of how religious he is.
I don't think because the story is him as much. And if you read, like, what's the book, Finding Elizabeth or whatever, and the press conferences and all this, you know, the real tragedy is you had this scared, quiet girl who was being bounced from domineering patriarch to domineering patriarch. And I don't mean to belittle her situation. It was awful. But the way that her father treated her, and I remember the bishop, or you remember when they found her and they said, she is pure in the eyes of the Lord. All these guys it was just the whole thing was a cluster.
He scares me. Yeah, Ed Smart kind of scares me.
And you know, and we say, you know, Glenn, you're kind of saying, well, this is more real. You know, here's a real girl who suffered. This is one of the problems with religion to me, is all this stuff that we joke about. You know, every year there's kids in the church who masturbate, who are normal kids, who kill themselves. It's all real. There are people who are suffering psychologically for a lot of the stuff the church does. And this is one that just puts it right out there and shines a bright light on it. But the problem is, what if you do take the religion seriously? What if you read about Nephi chopping off Laban's head and you feel that God's telling you the same thing? I hate to sound like Sam Harris here, but the problem with religion is some people take it seriously.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that there, John, was quite the soapbox.
I mean, I agree, and I can't
disagree with too much.
Hey,
no, I can't either. And it kind of goes back to just the discomfort that I feel, because when I look at like Brian David Mitchell singing his songs in the courtroom, and I don't know if he's trying to put on an act to say, convict me of being crazy, or if he really is crazy.
Well,
or
obviously,
if there's kind of a mix between the two.
Yeah.
And, you know, but then how crazy are any of us that are religious or used to be religious or, you know, right. not religious? Yeah. I mean, how crazy are any of us?
We're all crazy, and but
if we're saying that we're hearing God or feeling God, you know, one religious person or another religious person, it gets so messy. How you know, this guy's not hearing God. We're hearing God. That we know that God's not telling him, because we know what God really wants.
Right.
That's kind of scary to me.
Well, just as long as the behaviors don't come out as criminal. That's my only contention.
There's behaviors that aren't criminal that are still damaging, though.
True. But how do you regulate that, Zilpha?
I don't know. I'm reading Sam Harris's book. Maybe he'll give me some insights.
All right, you return the report then.
I think the scariest thing about Mitchell is, I think those of us who, you know, grew up in the church and took it seriously, we can all see at least a kernel of ourselves in him, and that's scary.
And I'll go scary even at a really low, numb level to say, if it's not criminal, and if it's not even just what was the other thing that you said?
Damaging.
Damaging. But you're looking at other person and you're judging them, saying I'm right and they're wrong. I think that's you know egotistical, and I think there's problems in that.
Yeah, but I think you need to read Sam Harris's book. He addresses that.
That egotism, that, you know, it just.
that sometimes.
But I think you get that on the other side too. I mean, I think you get that with Sam Harris as well, where you're saying, you know, there is no God, and the people who think that there's God, I'm right and they're wrong. I mean, I don't think you escape it. So I mean,
well,
this
just,
is going to take us down
as long
a different
as there aren't,
discussion. But
if you're not doing damaging things, then you're okay in Sam Harris's book.
All right.
Okay. Number two. The rollout of the new website, Mormon.org, and the I'm a Mormon campaign, the blitz of the, how many cities was it, 8 or 10 or 12, with the advertising campaigns trying to make Mormons look like regular people, like skateboarders and whatever else they did in the campaign.
Yeah, well, I don't think I realized people at the time that this was a limited release, like 8 or 10 cities.
Well, and it was a limited release. Was your area blitzed?
I don't know. I just saw it on YouTube.
And it was available on YouTube, but if you were in one of the key markets, I mean, they bought out a lot of advertising space.
I was in Japan at the time, so
okay.
You know, I wouldn't have been a key market.
I never saw it on TV. I only saw it on YouTube.
It would be fascinating to know that the church has always had one foot sort of in Madison Avenue, and it's done lots of these big campaigns. As far as I know, this is the biggest to date. And, you know, they tried to make it go viral. And I think there was some success in it. I know that, you know, on this podcast, it was sort of poo-pooed. I generally like the campaign. I thought it was well executed and well done. I think it's 20 years too late. I don't really think it'll work anymore. I don't really think that there will be people out there, you know, there'll be a tiny number, but nothing statistically significant. We'll see that and say, hey, yeah, I want to. And, you know, of course, the genesis behind it is they've done, and they've even acknowledged this stuff, they've done polls and people continue to say Mormons are weird, and they're trying to combat that view because their idea is that they can't get indoors because people have prejudice against the church.
Yeah, but they're supposed to be peculiar. They're not supposed to be normal.
No, we're trying to be normal now. So. I personally,
that's the new peculiar.
I really like the campaign too, but it wasn't without its controversy. I remember reading something about a couple people having their profiles up, and then them getting taken down because, you know, they later came out as gay, or they had mentioned that they were gay in it, so they were on the profile for a while and then they got removed. There's a few instances where even my heart breaks a little bit, like, oh, it could have been good if they would have left that up, but them taking it down, I think, makes matters worse.
Yeah, but, you know, I really think it spoke inside to the church members more than anything, and I think that gave sort of a self-esteem boost and probably was really more effective with some of the youth to realize. And I, you know, all in all, I think it was well executed. It was well done.
Yeah, I agree.
So do you know, John, because this was a question that came up when I talked with Holly and Jim, and none of us knew. Maybe you know, maybe you don't. What was the order? I mean, did the church solicit members to put their profiles up on the website, and then they selected from the ones that put their profiles up who they were going to profile on these videos, or did they do them in parallel?
No, my understanding was that it was a joint campaign. They had some people that they had selected, and they had pre-written the profiles and filmed them, and that was all packaged. And those came out simultaneously when the website came out, which allowed Mormons to go on and create their own profiles.
Okay, so the members that were creating their profiles were kind of given this template in the videos to use.
Right.
Okay.
That's my understanding. I mean, the people who were selected were obviously very carefully selected. I'm thinking of the motorcycle designer and the skateboard guy.
And the homemaker artist. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So these are not typical Mormons. And not that Mormons are not interesting people, but you don't get that many like motorcycle guys, you know,
right,
who that's if you were to drop into any ward in Sandy, you wouldn't like notice, hey, there's your motorcycle guy and there's the ward gay, to steal from Bishop Higgins.
Yeah, I thought this was I don't think it was 20 years too late. Maybe it was, but I think this was a positive move.
Yeah, I don't think it will do damage to the church. I don't think it makes the church look bad. I just can't imagine it being in this age of media saturation and so many things that go viral, especially at the target audience, which I would, because of the motorcycles and skateboards and the artists, I would assume they're targeting people under 30. I just don't think it would be, it make a big splash.
I just think that the only people who really like it are other Mormons that go, look at us.
I think so.
Well, but I think people outside the church don't dislike it. They're just like, yeah, you know.
Okay. I think if anything, they laugh at it. I mean, and maybe I'm just being too cynical, but I...
Yeah, you're being too cynical.
It was really hard when I looked to find anything other than... I think the anti-Mormon set and the critics overreacted to it.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it was really hard to find neutral press on it other than people in the city saying, gee whiz, the Mormons sure are advertising a lot here.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, why are they being negative on this? This just seems, you know, mediocre. It just seems like, you know, just a normal commercial. Are you going to complain about, you know, Crest toothpaste commercials next? I mean, it just seems...
No, but it's like the Mom Jeans commercial from Saturday Night Live. It's just funny. And the best parody was I'm a Rock parody from YouTube. It was fantastic. That was the best thing to come out of the Mormon ad.
I guess campaign. I don't know.
I still say the secondary story was the critical overreaction to it. I got the sense that, like, there's nothing the church could come out and say we like pancakes, and there's like a screaming set on RFM that would have
waffles are better.
Yeah. And I understand where that comes from. It comes from a lot of anger, and I'm not trying to offend anybody. Oh, hell's all to offend him. Yeah, they overreacted.
All right, what's our numero uno?
Okay, numero uno in my mind was the three-prong Packers conference talk denouncing the genetic origins of homosexuality, the ensuing protest, and then the national response from like the HRC, the Human Rights Council, you know, where just that, I think for the church, they got caught by surprise as that thing within a week just spiraled clear out of control until there was international press focused in on this old guy. Well, and the thing,
Prop 8's not that long ago, and then they do this in a conference.
Well, to me, one of the things on this story is we know that the new Handbook of Instruction came out a month later, which had verbiage which directly contradicted what Packer was saying, and the church revised in its print version Packer's words like day two.
Which is crazy.
Well, that shows that the church itself is not consistent on this message. So
no, it's the dying gasps of the old guard, you know. I mean, I think if you watch back, you can see the relish in his eyes. He just loves being able to still say it.
You know, this whole mess brought to my attention, because I always thought that the GA's talks were kind of screened.
Maybe
there's a few that don't have to have their talks screened, like President Packer. I don't know.
Well, yeah, maybe he says, if you want me to talk, then I'm going to say what I want
to
say.
Well, that's what they are screened, because I know they go to the translators a week early.
But that doesn't mean they're screened. That just means they have to get them in early.
They have to go through correlation, all that kind of stuff. But I think there's big, because you see the church going back and forth. If you look at the last couple of years with, you know, I'm thinking of the interview that Oaks and Marlon Jensen did with, was it Peggy Fletcher Stack or somebody, where they went real sort of liberalized, and they said, you know, we don't think it's a sin to be homosexual. You know, you just can't act on it. And then the church will come back, and it's you can tell the church is sort of wavering back and forth, that the brethren are not consistent on this one.
I think that's I was gonna say it reminds me of their stand on evolution too, because I don't think they agree on that one either.
No, but and I think, Tom, you were saying, you know, the look in his eyes, I'm reminded of like Jack Nicholson.
Oh, that wasn't me.
Oh, that was Glenn.
That was Glenn.
Sorry, Tom, I didn't mean it. Sorry, I apologize.
You can mix me and Tom up anytime you want. I think it's an honor to be mixed with Tom.
I'm thinking of Jack Nicholson, A Few Good Men. You know, he just wants to get yell at that punk kid.
Right.
And I think
right.
there's this whole element in the church, sort of the Joseph Fielding McConkies and the Packers. They really just want to get up and tell us how it is that homosexuals are going to hell and the Catholics right. are the great and abominable church and you know, all this other stuff. They just, you know, the Navajo or the Nephites, and you guys just need to, you know, we're going to Missouri, and they just want to say that stuff, and they just feel held back, and you can
totally
see it.
That moment when he goes, "Why would a loving God do that?" was his Jack Nicholson. You can't handle the truth. Totally. You nailed it.
So, and I really think, and you know, the study of, you know, the church is so careful, and just the bumbling of the church spokesman over the next 2 weeks as they responded to the protest, you know, which was a groundswell organization. There were, I don't know what the final count was, 700 or 800 people there overnight. And then the HRC and just all sorts of organizations that just made the church look really bad and focused negative light that I don't think they expected. And I think the church is slowly realizing that they can't just say whatever the hell they want at conference anymore.
Maybe.
I don't think that's a slow realization, because they hardly ever say anything at conference. I think they know that, but for some reason this one snuck through.
Yeah, and I think the only thing that, well, the main thing in Packer's talk that really sparked everything was that he insinuated that being homosexual was something that you're not born with, that it was a choice. I mean, if he would have just avoided that, I think his talk would have been fine and none of this would have happened.
Yeah, but he wants to call us all down.
He's not going to give up.
No.
He's not going to back down.
I think, you know, I feel sorry for him. I think he lives in a world that he no longer understands. That I think the brethren really believe that this is the stone cut out of the mountain, and they don't understand why growth has gone level, why they're losing so many youth, why there's punk podcasts coming online criticizing what they do.
Why so many people now think it's horrible for them to say that being gay is a choice. I mean, to them, that's just a given. Of course it's a choice. How could it not be? But but the broader world is starting to realize that it's not, and they just still don't see it that way.
Yep. I think you're seeing the dying gasps of the old guard. And
now I've got to read this. I just looked up an email real quick from a woman I've been in correspondence with that told me of an experience she had with Elder Packer many years ago. She said that he wrote on a 3x5 card a statement that came from a Catholic nun that said, "To believe in God is to know that all the rules are fair and there will be wonderful surprises." And I just wonder, what is he thinking of? Like, I get the all the rules are fair, but, and there will be wonderful surprises. What is the cryptic surprises about? Because it can't be what we would be thinking of as surprises. What is that about?
You mean wicked being punished? Wouldn't that be a surprise?
I think he would take a lot of relish in that. I think that's what he looks forward to. He's one, and you'll meet them in every ward. The Mormons who just want to see the world burn. And it's not just Mormons. There's all sort of evangelicals and others that way. But he's one of those
guys.
Stop
picking on the evangelicals.
No, well, and maybe a little bit of background. This was this was actually a woman who was in a relationship that was a non-traditional marriage. That met with Packer to talk about that situation.
And he wrote that for her.
He wrote that for her.
Wait, when you say non-traditional, how non-traditional are you talking about? You mean like they didn't throw white rice at their wedding, or?
No, a non-traditional marriage.
You mean an open marriage?
No.
Well, what are you talking about?
Yeah, spit it out, Glenn.
She's married to a man who was born as a woman.
Oh.
Oh, who cares?
Yeah, why would that involve the church?
That's the problem I have anymore. I mean, this stuff just doesn't. I mean, why does anybody care about stuff like that?
The guy had a sex change.
So what? If they love each other, who cares? Why does anybody care about that? I mean, I'm glad they have a relationship, but why does that bother people?
They're active members of the church.
Good.
And
But in the handbook, they can't ever. Well, the person with the sex change can't even get baptized.
But they're active members of the church, and they haven't been excommunicated.
Yeah, I think they can be baptized. I just think that there's other limitations.
I think well, it's the temple.
In the handbook, they can't get baptized if they're planning on having a sex change. But if they were born in the church and then they had a sex change, then I don't know what the...
Oh, maybe the first presidency approved that exception.
Can you get more pharisaical?
I don't think so.
I mean, just... Guys, go.
But the problem is
the church needs to read the New Testament.
But they think that gender is eternal, so you can't just change it. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know, the one thing about, as long as I've been making fun of religion, it always gets more ridiculous. It always gets more ridiculous the more time goes on. I mean, is there anything that religion's been teaching that you look back and say, oh, yeah, look at that one, right? Yeah.
Treat each other with kindness, maybe.
Well, yeah, but who has
a lot of people who weren't religious said that too.
And, you know, maybe I'm going to get stones thrown at me here. I was kind of bringing it up in Packer's defense because it surprised me that she went and had an interview with President Packer because she was in this relationship, and I expected, you know, the Packer that I hear about, that he would just, you know, be terrible to her, but he actually offered her this. He wrote down on this 3x5 card. This message that there would be these wonderful surprises in her life, and he didn't condemn her for what she was doing. It seemed so inconsistent.
You know, Glenn,
to me.
I've heard
but
this
the first
sort of thing.
Part of that 3x5 card. Read that part again.
Oh gosh,
I think that's the important
part. But
for
here,
him.
Here's my thing. I've heard this over and over again from different people who have these personal stories saying, you know, when you're one on one with the general authorities, they're not assholes. Well, they need to revamp their HR stand here. They need to go out with that sort of message. Why are they so kind in person, but when they get up and give talk, they're dicks? If they were just nice all the time, people would like them.
They're not dicks when they give talks, man.
Are you watching the same conference I am? Did you see the crawl under the Book of Mormon talk by Holland and the
14
pickle,
fundamentals.
The pickle talk by Bednar?
What happened to the John that said, I just feel bad for this guy. I just want to go up and give him a big hug.
I do feel
what
bad
happened
for
to
him.
That, John?
I feel bad for him because he's a grumpy old man spiritually telling kids to get off his lawn. And and I feel bad that he doesn't understand anymore, that he can't realize that it's okay for people just to be, you know, just to love who they're going to love, that it doesn't hurt him. It doesn't destroy anything, you know? he gave a very important talk a few years ago that points to his psychology. And the talk was about, you can only face one direction. Every middle manager should read it because it pulls that mindset in his history. It says you can either face up or face down. So basically, as a manager, you can either be a lackey to the people. You can either serve the people above you, the upline people, or serve the people below you. And the talk was, your responsibility is to serve the people above you, not the people underneath you. And I think Packer sort of sold his soul. He started as a school teacher, and he worked his way up through administration, and then he became a corporate man. And it comes out in talk after talk after talk that he's given over the past 30 years, where to him, it's loyalty to the institution, it's obedience to the rules, it's not about like love, it's not about relationships, it's about you achieve what you want through institutional loyalty, and I think that has crippled his soul.
Now you're going to make me cry.
Yeah, but I didn't think you believed in souls.
Well, I mean,
his ability,
metaphorically speaking,
to be open and loving.
I think we've all just witnessed a very sincere, loving John Larson, and that's great.
Well, I thought I was being mean, but you know, I feel bad for him, really, and he's really an intelligent guy. I like reading his stuff. He understands church doctrine. I think he's just got it backwards. It's about the people. It's not about the institution.
So you would hit him in the face and then hand him some flowers.
Okay? I'd give him a hug and pat him in the back a little too hard. All right.
All right.
Top so 10 stories from 2010, according to John, apparently.
Right. We're all just nodding our heads.
So what didn't I make on my list that you guys would have put on?
Oh, Barbara Smith, was that her
Well,
name?
Yeah, there's a lot of the, and I didn't want to leave anybody out, but there were a lot of notable deaths. Barbara Smith, Arnold Freeburg.
Anybody else? That wasn't a lot.
Those are the two I know offhand. That's one of the reasons I didn't. I was going to do, let's talk about all the Mormons who have passed, but I hadn't kept notes in the year. So. All right. As always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com, where you can leave your comments or let us know what you thought were the top stories. And we'll all be watching the happenings in 2011. And maybe great things will happen. Who knows what?
Happy New Year. Well, a little late.